Welcome to Hot Breath Comedy Fam. On Monday, May 13th, I am teaching a clean comedy workshop. The last four I have taught sold out very quickly. So if you want to learn about clean comedy, the business side, where the line is, how to write clean comedy, go to the link in the description of this episode and we'll see you there.
What about for comics who may not have much, or they're just that fear of the unknown? Is there any practices you've been able to develop to help you overcome that fear?
One of my favorite quotes in comedy is from Del Close, who he's one of the big improv guys in Chicago, affiliated with IO and some of the other. The quote is "Follow the fear," and that's I have that written in my joke book. Basically, if you're not comfortable doing something, you have to force yourself to do it on stage because of that time of forcing myself to do something that I wasn't comfortable with. So it's just kind of like throwing yourself in the deep end and trying to learn how to swim.
Hot breath. Welcome back, Hot Breathiverse. It is I, your host, Atlanta comedian Joel Byers. And you know what time it is. Hot Breath. This is the Hot Breath Podcast, your weekly guide to comedy mastery. Every Monday, we are releasing informative interviews about the craft of comedy. So welcome, Hot Brethren and Sistren, and a special welcome to our newest listeners that may have come over from the Jeremiah Wonders Podcast. Our guest today shouted out Hot Breath on his podcast, and we are excited to have you joining us here in the Hot Breathiverse. Congratulations, you are now official Hot Brethren and Hot Sistren. All we ask before we jump into this interview, if you do enjoy it, simply share it where you share other podcasts. Let people know that we exist and that there's some quality comedy content going on over here. And let Jeremiah know, hey, you shout out Hot Breath on your show. I went over and listened to your interview. I love it. I love the podcast now. Thanks for such a strong recommendation. And we'll keep growing together here, as there is only one thing left to do, and that is inhale a hot breath with Jeremiah Watkins.
Jeremiah Wonders.
Yeah.
Except yours is actually on, I think, right? Or is it in post?
It's on.
It's on?
But the only thing that's bad about it is, like, I need a new cable because sometimes it'll flicker out. I'm like, what's going on? And, like, the guest is like, what's happening? I'm like, I don't know what's happening right now. Like, Steve Simone and I were talking about ghosts in an episode and it started flickering and he's like, are you doing that?
What?
Like, no, dude, I'm not doing it.
That's incredible. I don't think people understand podcasting and the amount of work and trial and error that goes into this game, dude.
It's so much. It's so much. Yeah. Especially if you're producing your own stuff. Like, it's very tiring.
I've seen you post it, like, it was like 3 a.m. or something. You're like, just finished up this week's podcast.
Yeah.
It's like, it's due now. Here we go.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been there before.
Oh, yeah. That happens. I've been very consistent since I started it, but it's one of those things where it's like sometimes you have to get it done whenever your schedule's like a mess. Like, I've been on the road a lot lately and trying to plan that and get guests before I got on the road or double up before I go on the road, it's a little crazy, but been figuring it out. So
yeah. Have you found a system for it yet that kind of keeps it well oiled?
I try to get a guest earlier in the week. If you get a guest later in the week, if they cancel, you're just screwed.
Right.
So I try to do it early just in case.
Uh-huh. You know?
Yeah.
And prepare for the worst.
We actually had this plan for yesterday and we had to bump it to today. So that's always like a good, you know.
Totally.
Like, let's start early, and then if something comes up that's crazy, then we'll move it a day or whatever.
That's what I've learned, is even just get on the radar, even just a few weeks out, even just to kind of be like, hey, this is something that could be happening if you're interested.
Right.
And then as you get closer, it's kind of, you just kind of try to reel them in as it gets tighter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a fan of it, dude. Like, podcasting is booming right now, but your take on it, it's such a unique format. Like, we're sitting here talking, and I think the unique angle here is just that they're well-researched interviews. that you learn things that you wouldn't learn anywhere else. But yours, it's almost, it's like a TV show almost that you've converted to like a podcast. Are you conscious of that?
I don't know. I guess I haven't really looked at it like that, but yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah. It's definitely kind of like a part interview kind of, and then part riff session. And then it goes into like, you never know who's going to call in. There's these, a bunch of celebrities and different really big characters that call in that, you know, it's pretty amazing the reach of the podcast. You know, I just started in January, and
it's incredible.
The celebrities that we've gotten to call in on the show is it's pretty amazing. So,
hey, who are the kind of people you've had on there?
Oh man, we had Anthony Kiedis and Scott Stapp a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
They called in on Brooks Whelan's episode, and you know, I think different people have kind of a different draw. Like Bobby Lee's episode, like one of the earlier episodes. Yoko Ono called in, and the ghost of John Lennon. So
incredible, dude.
Yeah, it has, wow, a pretty. It's the reach is pretty impressive.
In Kevin Nealon's episode, I remember Adam Sandler called in.
Adam Sandler called in to Kevin Nealon, which you know, Kevin was really cool about accepting that phone call and letting him call in during his episode, letting him call in. They might make a Happy Gilmore 2, Sandler said. It's his words, not mine.
Yeah, yeah.
But who knows?
Do you have any goals with the podcast?
You know, honestly, it's a great outlet for me right now just to kind of do what I like to do with my characters and impressions and stuff. But really, it's to fuel people coming to see me for stand-up. It's kind of like, if you like this podcast, then you're going to love my stand-up because it's very present. It's very like, I try to, whenever I do longer sets, especially, every set is tailored to the room. You know what I mean? Like I'll do material every single time, of course, but I like having unique things like that are happening in the moment in each crowd.
How do you prepare for those? Like, is there a pre-show and analysis of the audience or?
Every once in a while before I go on stage, I'll literally just pop my head out and I'll just be like, I'll just kind of look who's in the front area and just get an idea sometimes. But for the most part, I go in pretty blind and then I just kind of like take it in. And like while I'm doing bits and material, I'm kind of scanning and looking for things. And it's kind of like a chessboard. You're keeping moves in mind for like later in the game, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just like, okay, that guy has a weird beard. Perfect. Okay. This lady she has a really interesting look. This lady over here, she's commenting after every joke I say.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm just like, okay, cool. I'm going to be able to work with this weird spider web of stuff. So,
and then how will you weave them in? Do you do more crowd work or like get them actually involved in the show? Or
it's just more crowd work and riffing, depending on the bit. Some bits I have like have room to like insert different people in or whatever, or it's just a matter of just riffing or doing crowd work with them, if depending on where it is in the set.
Yeah, especially if you're doing longer, like headlining sets. Like sometimes you feel like you could do an hour and a half. Other times you're like, oh, it's 20 minutes of material when it shrinks down and it's not going well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I do. I just did like a week of shows in Vegas, and those Vegas shows, whenever you're playing like near casinos and stuff, those are like my least favorite audiences because it's sometimes they can be good if they're like local people to Las Vegas, but it's mainly like whenever it's tons of people who are traveling, they're like, well, I already lost all my money and and I guess I'll go see this I got it comp for free, so I don't have any faith in these comedians because I never heard of them. Like,
of
they just go in like really low expectations.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, you're at a show, come on.
Yeah. How do you prepare yourself mentally to perform even if the audience isn't like giving you that feedback?
I've learned to deal with it differently over the years. Early on as a comic, I would handle it wrong. I'd get like really mad at the audience. I'd be like,
me too.
Come on. You can do better than this. I'm giving you everything I got, you know?
Yeah, oh yeah.
But
I was right there with you.
But I learned that that's not the best thing to do with audiences. A lot of times you can transform an audience if they're not the best if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You can kind of teach them a little bit, like how, what I would do. It's really for me, like a lot of the issues, like I have, like if I'm ever having a set that's not like, I'm like, what's going on with this? You know, when you're doing material and you're like, this material works, I do it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not working here? It's usually like a problem with your connection with the audience, or you're not like being present enough, or they don't feel like you're performing it for them. You're kind of performing over the audience rather than into the audience.
Interesting.
So what I like to do is that's whenever I kind of like slow everything down and stop things. And I, that's whenever I get in the moment, I'll start doing crowd work and be like, hey, what's going on, guys? Like, and then the, like for the Vegas crowds that I was just doing a couple weeks ago, I'm like, round of applause. How many people have actually been to a comedy show before? And then like you start realizing like there's a lot of people who have never been to a show before, and you're like, okay, this is factoring in. And then you start kind of breaking that down, and you're like, okay, I need to change my expectations a little bit of this crowd, because it's really easy to be killing with material somewhere, and then you go somewhere else and it's not getting the same response, and you're just like, yeah, it's a bad crowd. it's never me. It's I'm perfect. Yeah. These jokes I've written and performed everywhere, they're amazing. But yes. It's way harder to be like, oh, maybe it's me. maybe I need to adjust because something is going on with this crowd. A lot of times it could be something. This is an issue that I've had to learn because I'm a riffer, because I like to riff and open with different lines or whatever based on the crowd. Sometimes you say a line that buries you for the first line you say, it buries you for the next 5 minutes, because you're like, oh man, that was the wrong thing to say. Like I did a set in Hermosa Beach, very upper class, very white crowd, you know, south of here. And I said, I opened with something about race. I was like, wow, a lot of white people in here. Yeah, that's cool. Like something like it made them uncomfortable. They like got mad at me that I addressed how white the audience was, because there's only a few black people in there and maybe Hispanic or whatever. And I just wanted to address it. I was like, man, I feel like we're at a meeting or something. What's going on in here, guys? And they did not like that. They're like, absolutely not. And it buried me. Like,
interesting.
Yeah.
Were you able to crawl out?
Subjectively. It was like a 7 or 8 minute set. So like five of it was me being like, can we start over, guys? I mean, like I'd do a couple jokes and I'd be like, all right, you obviously are not digging what's going on up here. So sometimes you just have to take an L, like whenever it's a shorter set. You can win audiences back over, but if it's a short set and you open very poorly, sometimes you just got to plow through and be like, mwah.
Take that as a lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I had a lady walk out on a show for me being racist against white people. So apparently white people are a little...
Hashtag triggered.
Yeah.
what were you saying?
I was just making fun of how white people fell off. And like I have a line about the crackers going stale and this and that. And
well, I am offended.
I guess I should have said crackers. my bad, ma'am. My bad. So yeah, that was one of those experiences. You like, well, that wasn't me. But then, like, the next show, I bombed just because I'd built up such goodwill and having good shows. There's always one around the corner that's like, not yet, Sonny.
Oh, yeah. Whenever you have a successful run of shows, especially you go out on the road and then you come back to L.A. or wherever you're based out of, there's a bomb that's very close. it's a minefield that's about to happen.
And you produce, how many shows do you produce right now?
Just Stand Up on the Spot.
Stand Up on the Spot is the OG one. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I've been doing that show for over 7 years around Los Angeles. Almost, we're coming up on 8 very soon, within the next month. Coming up on 8 years of doing that show.
Oh, so you started, because you moved to LA in 2009?
Yeah, I started that show very quickly after I started stand up.
At Second City, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Where you have all that training.
Yeah. I literally, whenever I started the show, I was like 8 or 9 months into stand up. And it's like, yeah, it was, especially for how hard my show is. Stand on the Spot, as comedians, you go up with no prepared material and ask the audience for suggestions. And then the audience yells out suggestions like at an improv show, and then you have to create stand-up on the spot based off of those suggestions. So as a comic who's early in the game, it's definitely one of those things where it's difficult because you don't have the tool set and you don't know your voice yet early on, and you're just kind of scrambling. But the longer that you're into comedy, the more you know yourself and the more you know your voice, the easier it is. And then if you're just a funny person, you'll be successful at the show.
And even you're seeing, and it's funny to be like, yeah, I just have this show, stand up on the spot. But then this is like Joe Rogan, Burt Kreischer, like Whitney Cummings. Like, this is the elite of comedians you're seeing perform nightly at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
What have you learned from just even being around that level of success? Unpack it.
I learned a valuable lesson even last night. I was literally about to go on stage at the Comedy Store, and I got bumped by Dave Chappelle, and I waited for like an hour, and then he brought up T.I., and he and T.I. are like riffing and singing T.I. songs on stage, and I'm just sitting in the back like, am I still going on next? And they came over to me and they're like, not happening, dude. He's like doing too much time.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a lesson, like, no matter where you are, like where, like how you're feeling, like you're going to get checked repeatedly over and over throughout your career.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've been feeling pretty good lately, having some cool stuff going on. It's just like, it's like a sign, like, yo, keep working so you don't have to be bumped by this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, stay humble, keep your head down, keep working, and good things will happen. This is like, I mean, this is another, like, you get little ego checks all along the way. Not that I've ever really had personally any problems with like having a big ego or whatever, but you see it happen to different comedians around you and stuff like that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That's probably attributed to your success as well, don't you think?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
Just like not having an ego, and just like, I've done over 140 of these interviews, and a common theme for successful people is almost like, just be cool.
Yeah.
Just like, be easy to work with.
Yeah, because I mean, there's so many people out there that are talented and professional. Like, if you happen to be talented but you're hard to work with, like, you're gonna phase out. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, nobody, like, yeah, it's a very short-term, short-sighted person that's like, I'm gonna do me, like, I'm gonna do it this way, and like, I'm not gonna care like how this is affecting other people. And then like, the people who are fun to be around and easy to work with and cool, like, those are the people who have longevity in this field, or any career, really.
Yeah. And how did you moved to LA not knowing anyone? You're 20, right?
I was 20 years old when I moved
from Kansas to LA, not knowing anyone at all. One, just kudos to even committing. You clearly, I guess, saw something growing up, or like, what triggers? So many comedians are like, yeah, I'm going to go to Hollywood and do it, but to actually, one, make the move, and then to, two, actually be doing it. What, tell us through that motivation. What is how?
Yeah, I think part of it was, I think the issue with a lot of people who, and this is speaking from what I've seen over the years of people and friends who've come and go, who've come and gone. Basically, whenever I came out here, it wasn't just like on a whim, like, you know what? I'm going to move to LA and I'm going to pursue comedy. Like, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. It was very calculated. Like, I had been for years knowing that I was going to either move to LA, Chicago, or New York. Like, I was like, I was set. Like, I had already done my research. Chris Farley, I found out that he took classes at Improv Olympic and Second City. And I was like, okay, that's based out of Chicago, but they also got one in LA. And, you know, I also wanted to pursue stand-up, and I heard that the scene was good in L.A., and I'm like, oh, I heard you could do commercials out there, too. Like, mm-hmm. you can't do that, like, maybe as much in Chicago. And I just started, you know, kind of breaking down what I wanted and what I thought, realistically, I could book or what I could do.
Oh.
And I kind of just, you know, and the Venn diagram kind of met for me with L.A. New York was a little bit more... on the stand-up side, and I was like, well, I want to live in New York like eventually, but I think I kind of want to start in LA, and it's, you know, it's also easier for weather and stuff. Me coming from Kansas, I'm like, yeah. Oh, you know, sunny California, sunny LA.
How old are you doing this preparation?
I was probably around 17 or 18. I started researching people. I started looking it up because, like, nobody tells you that you can be a comedian. I think it's how to become a comedian. Nobody really tells you, like, that that's even an option. Like, that's not a box on career day or anything like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I started looking at it. Now, I think, you know, just in the last 5 years, it's so different. There's so many podcasts out there that are available that probably younger kids... it's way easier to be like, okay, I know kind of that you have a gist of like how to get a handle on where to go. And mm-hmm. like, if you listen, there's so many comedy podcasts out there now. But at the time, I literally like had to like, you know, look at books in the library or look it up online, like on the internet, like what the Second City was. Like, I was literally like a Wikipedia article where I was like, Chris Farley, like Jim Carrey, Steve Martin. I just started like looking up all these guys on Wikipedia and different stuff like that, yeah. and being like, how did they get their start? Because these guys are huge inspirations to me. These guys are like juggernauts of comedy. I want to learn. I want to do that.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, as a matter of, you know, Chris Farley, Second City, I was like, boom, Second City, there's one in LA. I'll start there. And after I turn 21, I'll start stand up because I had this preconceived notion. Because in Kansas City, you can't even get into most of the clubs or bars unless you're 21. And I didn't know in LA, like, that you could technically, you can perform and then they make you leave or whatever. It's weird.
You thought you had to be 21 to do stand-up?
Yeah. I thought it was like, you know, I was like, here's your driver's license. Here, now you're allowed to do stand-up. Yeah, you can drink now. Yeah. You know, like, I thought it was one of those things. Like...
Which you don't even do. You don't drink or do drugs.
No, uh-uh.
You're just weird on your own.
I'm just a weird guy.
It's great, dude. What about your parents? You grew up in a super strict, like, church household where, like, women couldn't even wear pants?
That was the church I went to growing up. My mom was just like, well, that's kind of crazy. Like, uh-huh. like, she, my mom, like, was... kind of, I feel like she enjoyed the church that we went to growing up, but she was kind of appeasing my dad, who that was where his mom, my grandma, went to church. So we were basically going to my grandma's church through childhood, and that's why it was so strict, because it's not really even my parents' generation's way of thinking. It was, you know, her mother, their, you know, my grandma's way of thinking. Like, and my grandma and grandpa were missionaries in the Cayman Islands. So they were obviously very strict, very religious people.
Uh-huh. Were they just cool with you just like, all right, I'm gonna go to LA. See you later.
Oh, my grandma is still like, my grandma's about to turn 90, she's still like worried about me. The only thing that she's like been proud of is I booked a Chevy Volt commercial. Played on like Fox News and CNN and like, you know, all the different like news markets.
Uh-huh.
And she said, she goes, if you can keep making ads for, you know, an upstanding company, an American company like Chevy, then I approve of what you're doing out there. It was so specific. Like, if you're doing this, right. then I approve of it.
Right, right.
But she knows, like, she's asked my aunt and uncle for years to like watch clips of me performing online, and they're like, they always change the subject. They're like, yeah, I mean, you know,
don't want cocaine joke will fly.
Yeah, I don't know if grandma wants to see me shave my pubes on Rose Battle. I don't think she'd be into that.
You're just a trailblazer, dude.
That's right, dude, man.
You've got to be the first to actually shave their pubes on television.
I am the first, as far as like a national like cable show. Like, to my knowledge, I don't think it's been done.
What are your parents' reaction to even the move, but then also what you're doing now?
My parents have always been really cool. They've been supportive, like very emotionally supportive. They're not like well off, like financially. So it's been like, you know, which is also honestly, it's been very good for me. Like, cause I've always had to hustle while I've been out here.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
I have some friends that are well off, or they come from money, and it's easy to get comfortable whenever you have supplemental income or you're getting income from somewhere else. Like, you're not quite as motivated. There's always exceptions to that, of course, but it's, for me, it's been really good that I've had to really work hard for every single thing that I've gotten, because it's definitely shaped me as a person and the comedian who I'm constantly working towards and becoming, you know.
Yeah, you appreciate it more too.
Absolutely. Everything. I'm just like, anytime I get to go out on the road and make a little bit of money, like with friends, like I've been very fortunate to be able to travel with different groups of friends, like Josh Adam Myers and the goddamn Comedy Jam, that crew, the Roast Battle crew, like Brian Moses and Jamar and Willie and all those guys. Mm-hmm. And then also recently with Tony Hinchcliffe and Red Band, like the Kill Tony crew. So I haven't had a normal road life experience where I'm a comedian, where I'm going out alone and I'm like depressed on the road and stuff like that. I've been surrounded by friends. So I've been super grateful to get opportunities where I can make a little bit of money here and there and, you know, not have to work a day job.
But moving out to LA at 20, not having really any background, you did morning radio.
Yeah, yeah.
When you were 19.
Yeah.
Stedman, I believe, was what
yeah.
you would go by.
You did your freaking there. Research.
Hey. That was like your...
hey.
Hey.
See that? It's called a research, yeah. Dude.
So what is that grind like initially? What is that hustle of even getting integrated into LA comedy?
I went completely to Second City and completely immersed myself in Second City. I didn't, whenever I got here, I literally knew nobody. So they had this student ID that you could get into shows for $1. Any show at Second City, $1. And I would literally every night see a couple shows a night. Like there. So I would be like that weird comedy guy who's just like in the audience, just like watching like every show, just like trying to take in and just watching these phenomenal improvisers. Some people at the top of their game. I watched Keegan-Michael Key for years before he got Key and Peele. And
wow.
I had the privilege of running lights for his improv shows with with his team and stuff. This great group called the 313 that has like Joshua Funk and Jamie Moyer and like Keith Ray and a couple other very talented improvisers. And Keegan was just like killing it. And I was like, this dude's really funny. Like, he had been in some stuff at that point, but I remember like being at a Second City Christmas party and I was like, hey man, what are you working on? Me and my buddy Jordan were like pitching the show around and
wow.
You know, it's kind of like a Chappelle show kind of feel to it. But you know, it's like our own version of a sketch show that we're pitching around. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. And you know, and then Key and Peele exploded a couple of years later after that.
Incredible.
Yeah, and he's super super nice. Like he's the kind of guy who'd be like after the show, he'd be like, dude, you did a great job, like on that pull and the light. Your timing was really good, like for the transitions between scenes or whatever.
Uh-huh.
This stuff that you don't really have to tell, like an intern, like who's just working hours. Like that's how I paid for classes at Second City. Is I interned there,
okay.
I would do everything. Like I'd run lights. I edited video for them for whenever they had like their YouTube channel going for a while. Clean the bathrooms at the end of the night, all that stuff, and it paid for almost all of my tuition there. Like I only had to pay for my first or second class before I got accepted as an intern.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did their intro for actors program, then I did their conservatory program, their musical improv program, and their long form improv program. So I did all that and paid for it with intern hours.
Is there a few takeaways that you still apply or that just always resonate with you that you had from that experience in that school?
Oh yeah. I mean, the Second City has definitely like, there's definitely like an imprint on me from that with my comedy. Like that's where, you know, I started stand up on the spot was there. And then also it, that's where I think it really taught me how important it is to be present and in the moment and be connecting with people.
Mm.
I think that you can kind of go on autopilot as a stand-up sometimes, but like I said before, if you take a step back sometimes, like that's what the audience needs, is they need something like right now. They need to know that it's not like you're watching TV, you know what I mean? That anything can happen. That's what's the most exciting thing about stand-up, is you don't know, like for me, like if like I love stepping off the stage and going into the crowd sometimes because people are like, whoa, what is, I'm not used to this.
Right.
Like I'm used to like just like sitting in a chair and flipping the channel if I don't like it. But I like, you know, I get in people's faces. I like, you know, like messing with the room and seeing what's going on. Mm-hmm. So Second City definitely like has made me like a very like present performer and just feeling like the freedom to, if the material's not going well, I have a huge tool belt of improv at my disposal. So there's always a backup. And if that runs out of steam, you go back to the material. So it's like this great crossover.
What about for comics who may not have much, or they're just that fear of the unknown? Is there any practices you've been able to develop to help you overcome that fear?
One of my favorite quotes in comedy is from Del Close, who he's one of the big improv guys in Chicago, affiliated with IO and some of the other theaters there. The quote is, follow the fear. And that's I have that written in my joke book as one of the like the first pages. And basically, if you're not comfortable doing something, you have to force yourself to do it on stage. And usually you benefit from it after you do it a few times. Like it'll make you a stronger performer. Like for years, I would really admire comedians who did one-liners because that's not what I do. I'm an act out guy. I do characters. I do like these grandiose performance bits and impressions and stuff like that. So I would see different guys go up, like Angela Bowers and Tyler Green, different like guys who like really strong writing and condensed into these one-liners. And I'm like, I need to force myself to do that. And I did it for like 6 months where I would try one-liners occasionally at mics and they were horrible. But I've got like a handful of one-liners that I still use in my act now because of that time of forcing myself to do something that I wasn't comfortable with. So it's just kind of like throwing yourself in the deep end and trying to learn how to swim.
Yeah. And one-liners, that's almost like playing scales in comedy. Like that's like the mechanism of a laugh is understanding like where you're taking them and then where you're breaking them.
Yeah.
So that I started out doing one-liners and that's, I don't do them. I still have some I'll just whip out like you said, but it's more now of just having that understanding of the mechanism of a joke, and then you can start to weave that into a more organic delivery.
Sure.
But it's some people just be Rodney Dangerfield and just spit them out like one after the other. But
yeah,
I feel like it seems in comedy right now, and there's nothing wrong with one-liner comedians, but it seems more than ever people are almost more like just focusing on the personality side of stand-up and just being authentic on stage. And the audiences seem to be a little more open-minded and just, okay, let's see where this goes.
Yeah.
Do you feel that too?
Oh, I definitely feel that.
Yeah. Did you just, I feel like you just.
Yeah, I hope it goes away. Yeah, yeah. I hope it leaves eventually. Sorry if I was like, yeah, yeah, I'm aware of what you're talking about.
No, but
yeah,
I was just massaging the idea in there. What do you think about it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm like, here's the thing. It's like, at the end of the day, like, for me, I'm a guy who, I go very big on stage, so that's kind of the opposite of what I do. So I don't have, and probably on the same flip side, like some comedians who are very much about like, I'm just going to share what I feel. Like I think there's all room for that in like, you know, the total spectrum of comedy. But the problem that I have with it is if there's not enough punchlines
yes,
that
exactly.
are in there. That's yes. my only issue with it is like, you know, you do certain rooms and it's funny, like you're almost condemned for doing punchlines sometimes. And yeah. it's just like, what are you talking about? Like that's what we're doing here. This is a show. This yeah. is like,
gotta be
this
funny.
Is a performance. It's gotta be funny.
Yeah.
So that's why I you know, that's why I kind of laughed a little bit whenever you said that, because I'm very well aware of that.
I feel like it is just like a fad or a trend.
I think so. Here's the thing. I don't think that some of that is. I don't think some of the era of comedy that we're in right now is going to hold up like 10, 15, 20 years from now. Like, you know how you watch some of the great specials and you're like, wow. For the most part, other than like some time, like some referential stuff to that time period or like pop culture, this holds up. There's like, it's funny. Like, I get why this is huge, but I feel like some of the stuff that we're in right now, and even the music, like, I'm wondering if mumble rap is going to be revered in 20 years from now. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. I think that's a good note for young comics too, is maybe focus on the funny first. It's almost like people looking for the shortcut into just being
yeah.
cool, man.
Well, that's the thing. It's like whenever somebody's trying to be too cool on stage, or like they're trying to be too smarmy or too smart, I'm like, I just love to get stupid up there. Like, right. I love to be silly and wild, and like, I don't care about making a fool out of myself. I mean, if the audience is laughing at you or with you, it's like, you know, you're getting laughs. That's what they're there for, is to brighten their day. So uh-huh. like, rather than being like, I'm moved by this. I mean, that's something, I think that's a different format. I think that you can do both. There's comedians. I mean, the master comedians can do both, but whenever there's the lack of like what I'm saying, like the punchlines and
right.
the laughter, that's when I'm like, eh, that's just not my style. It's not for me.
But even to develop your style, it takes years of stage time and hours of stage time. And through that, there is a lot of failure involved. And I can only imagine with your personality on stage, just some of the epic bombs that have had to have gone down.
I have probably bombed harder than most comedians that you have seen.
Yes. That's what I laugh the hardest when a comedian's bombing.
Well, yeah, dude. I mean, whenever you see your buddy bomb, that's some of the hardest laughs I've ever had in my life, is watching friends just be like, oh, oh no. It's just like quicksand. The audience is just like consuming them. And you're in the back just like dying, me like, yes, yes, this is amazing. They went up there so cocky and they were like, oh, I'm going to fix this room. And then just like completely.
My favorite.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah.
But what is probably one of the most epic bombs you've ever had?
Man.
Or if you've gotten booed on stage or...
I haven't really gotten booed on stage. I don't know, something about my personality or maybe something about my confidence on stage. I don't know. It triggers a lot of hecklers if I'm not having a good set. Like, I do not know why, but I've had to deal with a lot of people just like in weird environments. It's never like really like the great like clubs or venues like where you get heckled. It's like your random bar shows where you're like, I don't want to be here. Like, why is this person adding to this? I don't know. I mean, I've just had a bunch of sets where it's so quiet after I do this long act out where it's just like they don't even like, you can hear like your own breath, like inhaling and exhaling, like that's the only thing you hear in the room is and it's this feeling of like, is laughter or are the claps ever gonna come? And then you have to comment and you're like, All right. So I guess you guys didn't like that, or on to this next bit. I mean, one epic bomb really that I always go back to is this set that I had at the Laugh Factory years ago, where it was early on in my stand up. I just remember it so vividly as like probably one of the worst times I felt on stage. Is I wasn't quite dialed in with my physicality yet. I would just be like super spastic on stage, and I wasn't like, I would like to think of my set now as more of a controlled chaos. Like, it's dialed in. I know my parameters. I know my reach and everything. Long story short, I did this dumb act out where I kicked a stool into the audience, and it landed on the front row. It spilled this guy's drinks all over his iPhone, all over his wallet, all over his lap, and his date. And I was just like, I didn't have the tools as a comedian yet to address it properly and really apologize. I literally was like, like, and like a waitress is coming in to towel this guy off, and he's like fuming, mad and furious. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And then I just go right in the next bit right after that. I didn't know what to do because I still had time left. Like, I wasn't lit yet. And I just like started sweating. I was like, I'm so sorry. So you guys ever notice how like right into the next bit and the audience is like, oh my, what? He just knocked a stool into the crowd and just knocked drinks all over the, and he's going right back into material. And it was just like this. Like, the bomb was so huge, but the fact that I wasn't self-aware made me bomb even harder.
Mm-hmm. And probably not recover.
Oh, no. No, it was horrible.
How long into your career was that?
Dude, it was like probably, honestly, 2 years in.
2 years.
And it was my buddy's birthday that I invited him. And he brought a bunch of friends. He's like, it's my birthday. Dude, my friend is really funny. He's been killing it. And I just, dude, I just crapped the bed entirely.
Yeah, you thought you were still a soccer player, I guess.
Yeah.
That you still had those soccer skills.
Dude, that's a mess.
That's what you learned from, man.
Yeah.
Failure's the best teacher.
Of course.
That's why I always like to bring those up on here, is so people don't... Oh, this is Fontys, by the way. This is our water sponsor.
What?
But full disclosure... This is actually LA tap water, because I couldn't get these on the plane.
Right.
So it is just LA tap water. That's hilarious. Feel free to take some if you'd like. But yeah, they made us labels. Because you do sponsors on yours too.
Yeah, you? This is cool though. I've never seen anything like this for
And you've seen a podcast.
And I've seen a lot.
You've seen it all. You're my Watkins. Touring around doing, I mean, the Kill Tony podcast, and then doing your own stuff. It's really, it's all... I don't even know how to describe it, just because first time I saw you was on a roast battle when I was like doing one of the stand-up sets a few years ago in LA. This is before I even really knew what roast battle was. They're like, and I was in town, and
they're like, come do a set.
Do a set. And then I see it and I'm like, who is it? And you got the wave is just like diving all over everything. And then I see Kill Tony as well. And just the wealth of characters you have to develop on a weekly basis. That output it's astronomical, dude.
Yeah, it's been a little more intense lately because we've been going on the road. We just did 3 Kill Tonys on the road, and we come up with new characters every episode. So we did one on Monday. We did 3 on between Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. And then we just did another one last night. So we had to do 5 like new characters, or... we'll bring back characters to kind of like space out, because, you know, if a character is successful, we'll bring it back and like keep honing it and keep trying to make it better and tighter and stuff like that. But we had to do 5 within 7 or 8 days. And that was a lot.
How organized is that aspect? Cause like you said, controlled chaos. And that's why I'm such a fan of you, is because you are able to pull off what seemingly is absurd, but it's very well calculated. It's like like you said, the Second City background, like everything is honed in and purposeful. But I love when people are able to walk that line in comedy between like, what? But it's so well executed that it's palatable, you know?
Yeah. Well, I learned that if you kind of set the parameters for yourself with jokes or a show or whatever, and you set your own guidelines, then you have the full room to play because you know where the boundaries are. You know how far you can push things because you have like a template, basically. So for the characters for Kill Tony, we have like this master list where we'll have like brainstorm sessions where we're like, we could do this, 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 this. Like we start writing just like everything that we think that could be fun or cool to commit to basically for, you know, a 90 minute episode. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the characters never come back because they're either really hard to improvise within or they're not three dimensional enough. They're too like one dimensional, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
So like we just did these nurse characters like a couple weeks ago, and maybe if we took another crack at them, but like try improvising just as a nurse for 90 minutes. It's like, you know, you throw out your medical terms and stuff like that, but like after that it's like, yeah, but what's your point of view as the nurse? And sometimes on the format of a show like Kill Tony, like sometimes you can't get to the point of view, and if you don't get to your point of view, then you can't play. You know what I mean? Like in an improv scene, that's why there's rules like that they teach you at improv schools, like set up the who, what, where, when, the why. Like set those up, then you can play. Because if you don't set those up, then you're just kind of floating around in this black void of space where you're like, I don't really know this information yet, and it hasn't been established, so I can't really hit the ground running like until that stuff is set. So that's what will happen sometimes with the characters that we don't bring back, is we never found the point of view for those characters, and we have to analyze and try to figure that out, if that makes sense.
So are you trying to find those answers before the show, or is this all in the motion?
So we try to find it before the show, but sometimes it's like whenever we're doing like five characters in, you know, 7 or 8 days, you sometimes find it middle of the show, and then you're like, that's what this character's thing is.
Whoa.
So sometimes before the show, ideally, you'd like to have a strong point of view with the characters, but sometimes you may not know it. You're just like, I just think this is like inherently something in my gut is like, there's something funny about this character or this profession or whatever. And then you find it kind of as you go.
How do you find the point of view? Like you said, some you find before the show. What is your process for finding that?
That's kind of a trial and error kind of thing. Like you also, it depends heavily on what the audience is responding to as well, or what the guests on the show are, or the or you know, host or co-host, whatever. If they're like, we found this one character where I didn't find this angle till towards the end of the episode, where, and I'll bring this character back eventually because it did really well, but I was Darth Vader, and like I was playing it pretty straightforward as Darth Vader, and later on the show I was literally getting hot and tired, and my posture changed to eventually where my head is down, and they're like, are you okay over there? I'm like, I'm not doing well right now. And they're like, what's wrong, Vader? Like, you know, and then like it got a big response from the audience, and I'm like, we started like going back and forth, and we came up with like the angle that is really funny, like for a take on Darth Vader, is he's really sad. So it was like sad Vader. Yeah. And they kept going back like later in the episode, they're like, is everything okay over there? And I'd just be super depressing and low every time they come back to me. And like, I haven't seen my son in years. Like just stupid stuff like that. But you find stuff like that. Sometimes it takes a while, like I said, trial and error to kind of figure out like what would be funny about that.
And that becomes the game.
Yeah, then that becomes the game, and you just heighten, heighten, heighten.
So in stand-up, if you're doing a lot of improv on stage, are you recording these sets and reviewing them?
I audio record all my sets. So if I am riffing something on stage that I liked, then I'll go back and listen to it, and I definitely will transcribe stuff and try to rework it.
All the way out. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You're that. That's the work behind it.
People, that's the work. It. That's like where, you know, it's fun to go up on stage. It's the work to go back and listen to sets that you don't really want to listen to.
They're never really as bad as you think they are. when you listen back, they're never really as good listening back either.
Sometimes. I know.
Yeah,
I know. I did strike. And then you listen back and you're like,
all right.
I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah. But then you think the bombs are the worst or the hardest to listen to. Because when you kill, you're like, well, of course, let me do my victory lap and listen.
Yeah.
But when it doesn't go well, those are the ones you got to listen to. Because you may find a spark in there.
Sometimes, it depends. I'm all about keeping a healthy and positive mindset. Mm. And if it's going to be really negatively impact like your mental psyche, then like I usually am like, I know what I did wrong. I can't listen to this. This is like, you know, but I used to force myself. I used to like early on as a comedian, I used to like nine tails, like, no, listen to it. No, learn what you did. Learn from all the mistakes, Jeremiah. But I don't do that so much anymore because I'm like, I know what I did wrong there. I know what, like, you learn your lessons a little bit quicker.
True.
As you go on.
Yeah.
Because you've made those mistakes. Sometimes you're like, I've already made that mistake. Why am I doing that?
Mm-hmm. But it takes that review process to then create the awareness
of
like, I made this mistake. Okay. Or in the middle of a show, you may, I made that mistake again, but I know I can recover based on that awareness now.
Yeah.
I think as someone who put that, the reviewing perspective, because it's so hard to have the discipline to do it. But then I heard like Joe Rogan interview be like, he's like, they're like, you listen to all your sets? He's like, do your homework. Like, what do you mean? Yes, I listen to my sets. Do your homework. It's part of the work. And he just said it just so flatly of like, no, this is part of being a comedian. Do you want to be a comedian? Do you want to be good? Or what level do you want to be a comedian at?
Yeah.
So even someone at his level is like, gotta do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I like people to appreciate in this podcast is just the work and the labor that goes in to, they're just talking for an hour. It's like, you didn't see the 20 hours of failure behind that hour.
Yeah, behind the one, the working on one joke.
Yeah. But what are you, you moved to LA to get on SNL. That was like that was my big super objective.
Yeah, for sure.
So it still is.
Yeah, I still haven't, I have not auditioned for the show yet, so I just keep working towards that. And, you know, I've sent in like tapes and some writing packets and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and gotten a little bit of feedback here and there. But yeah, just waiting to audition for the show.
So as you're getting heat, as I say in the industry, you're hot, Jeremiah. You got the heat. So you've been connecting more with maybe the business side of show business. Do you have any takeaways or lessons you could share with listeners on getting into that world?
Like we said, just going back earlier in the podcast, you have to be enjoyable to be around.
Mm.
And don't be pushy where people are going to be annoyed of you or whatever. Like, you don't want to be the person who like hits up show bookers like all the time. You're like, hey, when are you going to book me? When are you going to book me? That's like the worst thing that you can do is desperation, basically.
Oh.
Like, and I got a great note from like a Groundlings class. At the end of the class, his teacher, he told me, he's like, you're great, but you want this too much. He's like, it's palpable how badly you want this. And he goes, if you keep your attitude how you are right now, you're never going to book anything out here. He just was like, you're never going to book anything. He goes, you want this too bad. He goes, yeah, you have the skill set. You have the talent. But he goes, you need to zen out.
Mm.
And that was one of the best notes that I got after taking a class somewhere.
Mm.
It's like, yo. And my buddy, Tony Hinchcliffe, and he got this from our pal Jeff Ross. Tony told me last night, he's like, you remember what Jeff always says? Three words, enjoy the process. It's super important because Tony saw me fuming mad last night because I got bumped by Chappelle and I really want to go up. I'm a comedian. You know what I mean? Like, I know he's one of the greats. He's a legend. But also at the same time, it's weird to say, I never thought that I would be at a place in my comedy where I'm like frustrated that I'm getting bumped by a legend. You know what I mean?
Seriously. Yeah.
But it's like at the same time, like, I'm like, I have stuff that I want to work on. Like you get a little bit, it's easy to get a little bit jaded sometimes. And you're like, I've seen him. I get it. He's great. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like he's one of the best. I'm trying to be one of the best. Let me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, and Tony saw me like kind of upset, just like kind of staring at the stage last night watching Chappelle. And he's like, enjoy the process, dude. Take in these moments. And I forced myself to watch most of his set. I was there for like an hour, hour and a half. And I forced myself to watch what he was doing and appreciate, you know, his skill set. He was doing no material and killing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
He was doing it for like over an hour. He was just kind of playing with the room and doing whatever. I was like just sitting in the back, just like watching. Just be like, okay, get back to work, dude.
Yeah.
Get back to work so you don't get bumped.
Yeah, because it's never what you think. Like, to become a paid regular at Comedy Store, you were like guaranteed the spot, and then it didn't happen for like another 2 years after that. Like, isn't that the process of climbing? Then you go from like potluck to friends and family to then paid regular.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had built a lot of quick momentum, and then it all kind of fell to the wayside a little bit. That had to be kind of a check. Process.
Well, yeah. So basically, I was doing the potluck like in 2011. And by the time 2012 came around, I was on the friends and family list. So within, you know, and like within 6 months, I graduated from the open mic to friends and family, which people were like, whoa, that, you know, that's crazy. Like, good for you. But like, that's like quick. And then I was in friends and family from 2012 to the fall of 2016 when I got passed.
Okay.
So it was 4 years and like 8 or 9 months of being in that gray area.
Uh-huh.
You know, of like, I got promoted from the open mic, but I'm not good enough to be like a paid regular. You're considered a non-paid regular where you can call in for spots. But you can't, you know, you can't park there. You don't get paid. Like the sets are much shorter. You get development spots or like 5 minute sets.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're in Comedy Store is the mecca as far as I'm concerned of comedy and is booming right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're right in the middle of it. That's so gnarly. You're around the best comedians alive.
Well, it's crazy. Nightly. Like there'll be some comics who complain about like where they're going at in the lineup, like how they're like I'm going up too late, and then you're just like, look who's above you. It's just like all these like murders,
yeah,
like nationally touring, like amazing comics. Like, who are you gonna replace, huh? Bill Burr, Mark Maron, Chris D'Elia, Bert Kreischer, Tom Segura, Whitney Cummings, Elijah Schlesinger, like Bobby Lee, like those are who are going up in exactly. those sections. Like, who are you going to replace out of that? It's like, know your place, you know? I'm just like, anytime I'm like on the lineup, I'm like, I love the lineup.
Seriously, like,
it's great.
I've only performed in the belly room there a couple times. So even just, and I'll watch, and I'll go back and forth between the original and the main room while I'm waiting and just like constantly going back and forth.
Yeah,
just
it's watching. Incredible.
So just even to be in the original room or say you're on the list for the original room, I'm like, yes, that is a goal of mine for sure.
Yeah.
To graduate.
Heck so. Yeah.
Sorry, I've taken up. I went a little bit long with you, sir, but we can land this plane here. You've been very helpful and informative. I appreciate your time. So, before we get out of here, is there anything else you want the world to know?
You know, I'll just plug my podcast.
Yeah.
Check out Jeremiah Wonders. I'm at Jeremiah Stand Up on social media, and then I might be in a city near you soon doing some stand up. So, yeah, check out Kill Tony as well. That's a super fun show that we were talking about on here.
Yeah.
But yeah,
podcast.
Other than that, just, you know, be a good person, keep working hard, and, you know, don't have an ego, and it'll really pay off.
Boom. Jeremiah Watkins, thanks for being on Hot Breath,
yeah,
my man.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Woo! Oh, what was that?
The Zoom?
Oh, it wasn't the Zooms. That's all that matters. Thank you so much for listening, Hot Breathiverse. If you enjoyed this Hot Breathisode, please quickly leave a 5-star review on our iTunes page. Share this episode with friends and fellow comedians. And reach out to our guests directly. Let them know their time on Hot Breath was very well received and that you learned a lot. If you'd like to support the show, because this is a one-man production, so the more support we get, the more we can bring you, head on over to our website, hotbreathpodcast.com. On there, you can get information about how you yourself can become a sponsor of the show. You can also pick up some merch and check out our blog that covers past episodes and our podcasting equipment and just a lot of fun additional content. More additional content, if you like these audio versions, you will love the video. We have our own YouTube page. Just go on youtube.com/hotbreathpod. Subscribe, watch these episodes with your own eyes, and see our guests in their full form. If you want to learn more about me and my classes here, I teach classes in Atlanta, but also online courses, and I do Skype sessions with people. Head on over to joelbyerscomedy.com. It's a great place you can get more information about my performance schedule and how you can book me to come to your town. And finally, if you want to engage with fellow listeners, head on over to our Facebook community. Go on Facebook, search Hot Breath Comedy Network, request to join, and there's a whole slew of us in there from around the world sharing all of our favorite episodes and also comedy insights, and it's just a great place to connect with like-minded people. So all that being said, thank you so much for listening. I thank, at the end of all of my episodes, my wife for making the theme song of Hot Breath Podcast. And until next Monday, right here on Hot Breath. Hot Breath. This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.